This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory on the University of British Columbia campus. Hello and welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and today we are speaking with Linda Kohanov. She is the author of the best-selling book, The Tao of Equus, and she's here today to talk about her latest book, The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a revolutionary model for socially intelligent leadership. And Linda speaks and teaches internationally. She established Epona Quest worldwide to explore the healing potential of working with horses, and she offers programs on everything from emotional and social intelligence, leadership, stress reduction and parenting, to consensus building and mindfulness. Her main website is eponaquest.com, and you can also find her at masterherder.com. Welcome to the show, Linda.
Thank you, Marie. It's great to be here.
Thanks for being with us. So maybe you can give us a little bit of an overview on what do horses have to do with human leadership?
When I was researching my previous book, The Power of the Herd, a non-predatory approach to social intelligence, leadership, and innovation, I was looking at leaders throughout history and across multiple cultures. And I noticed there was an unusually high number of innovative leaders who were also exceptional horsemen. And this would include George Washington, who was considered one of the finest horse trainers in the colonies, not just a great rider. It also includes the Buddha, who was an exceptional horseman when he was still Prince Siddhartha. And from working with these animals over the years, they demand a high level of mindfulness and also the ability to lead and influence a horse in such a way as a lot of times you're asking a horse, which is an herbivore, they're large, powerful herbivores, you're asking them to override some of their basic survival instincts to move forward in a direction that asks them to engage a lot of power and grace and courage. And a lot of times horses on their own aren't really that ambitious, but combined with a great rider like George Washington, these animals can be taught to go into the center of a bloody battle, stand still during cannon fire and gunfire. And when you see someone like George Washington, who was able to ask entire groups of people to override their most basic and sometimes most selfish survival instincts to work for the good of the common goals of freedom, you begin to see how he was able to use the skills he learned riding and training horses to influence large groups of people. Mm.
So, Linda, it sounds like one of the main elements of that is the mindfulness aspect. And also, it sounds like having trust in the leader is really important.
Yes, you have to be mindful, extremely mindful in the presence of horses, because they're huge and they can panic and knock you over and kick you accidentally just out of their own startle responses or fear. And so to get them to override those startle responses, their fear responses, you actually have to have an incredible ability to build trust and also act as, well, you have to just have a significant leadership presence that's about gaining the horse's cooperation. Because if you just use dominant submission and abusive techniques, these animals will actually panic and drop you on the ground during times of stress. So if you're going to do ambitious things with horses, you actually have to have them gain confidence in you as someone who's trustworthy, but also capable of rallying their tremendous power toward goals that they wouldn't normally come up with themselves.
Wow. And I mean, it might be obvious, but I'd love to hear you articulate why that's important to be able to do that with humans.
It has to do with the era in which we live to a certain extent. We live in this era of rapid change and unprecedented freedom in many cases. We need creative, empowered people who are capable of adjusting to constantly changing markets, interact with others internationally from other cultures. We need people to be able to capitalize on innovations that are emerging at breakneck speed. You see that conflicts and power struggles between professionals are common. And when I discovered this in researching animal and human behavior, I realized that a lot of these conflicts are actually instinctual. So you will come across the same elements of resistance in horses that you see among people. And when I was writing The Five Roles of a Master Herder, I realized that people will take on certain roles that they become almost addicted to. And a lot of times people don't even understand each other because they have a preference for different kinds of roles of power and social influence. When I studied that these nomadic pastoral tribes in particular, these are tribes that migrate with large animals. They actually employ a socially intelligent form of herd management that allows these interspecies communities to move across massive landscapes. These people have to deal with predators and changing climates. They have to protect and nurture the group while keeping these massive, sometimes aggressive horses and cattle together. And the key is this: they have to do it without the benefit of fences and with very little reliance on restraints. That is the dilemma that many leaders have today. We can't control people like we used to with our old dominant submission paradigms and the idea that a person is going to live in one place and have one job for his entire life. People have options now. The stakes are especially high in innovative fields. So if you have a neglectful or heavy-handed manager alienating gifted staff members, and these are the ones who can really help a company or a nonprofit or a community organization shine, your most competent, most talented employees might do something more infuriating than just quit. They might become the competition. Because these days, anyone with a great idea can raise money online. They can order supplies delivered to the door. And they can conceive a multi-million dollar corporation in the corner of a basement or a garage. So now more than ever, people are more empowered, they're more free, they have more choices. And businesses need sophisticated leadership skills to attract and keep these intelligent, inventive, empowered people on board.
Thank you, Linda. We are speaking with Linda Kohanov. She is the author of The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a revolutionary model for socially intelligent leadership. And Linda, so this is the ideal of becoming this master herder, and we'll talk more about what that means throughout the hour. But why do you think it is that it's so common to have terrible leadership? Because that seems more common than to have an amazing leader who inspires and empowers his people or her people to do great things.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's been statistically shown that there was a Gallup poll of more than a million U.S. workers, and they show that the number one reason people quit their jobs has to do with a bad boss or immediate supervisor. Gallup also determined that poorly managed workers are 50% less productive and 44% less profitable than well-managed groups. This is a big problem. And the reason it's a problem is because people don't really study leadership and social intelligence skills. We might spend years learning how to become a brain surgeon or a rocket scientist or a school teacher, but we aren't really taught, or we don't even really seem to spend time learning about leadership and the social intelligence skills that go along with motivating large groups of people toward a common goal and handling their various conflicts along the way and getting them back on track and finding out what support they need to succeed. We're expected to learn those things accidentally. It's ridiculous. Another factor is that only about 10% of human communication is verbal. This was studied in the 1990s. So that means that 90% of the messages we send back and forth to each other are in this nonverbal range of body language and how we can adjust and engage energy and inspiration and add assertiveness and set boundaries with others. A lot of these things are done primarily through nonverbal means if they're going to be effective. And in our culture, we overemphasize words and verbal learning. So it would be almost like if you showed up to get a degree in engineering that would allow you to become a rocket scientist. If you showed up on the first day of school and somebody said to you, oh, we're so excited to have you join our program, and you're going to learn about 10% of what you need to be successful. Mm-hmm. That would seem crazy, especially when people are shooting rockets around the world that can blow up. So, you know, we seem to have the capacity to teach people the technical skills, but we are a priority in teaching people the leadership and social intelligence skills is like way down on our priority list. We can see in our current political chaos that's happening that people just don't understand how to lead and collaborate and to air differences and debate in respectful, productive ways because they haven't been taught this. Everybody's expected to learn this accidentally. And the skills associated with leadership and social intelligence are essential in a democracy where everybody has a vote and everybody is supposed to be free and able to come forward and influence the government. Well, if you're still using the same skills that, you know, kings and slaves used right around the time the Revolutionary War freed us, if you don't have more sophisticated skills than that, you're just going to be in a limbo, which is exactly what we're in. We don't have the skills to move forward and really make democracy reach its potential.
Hmm. Thank you, Linda. Now, I'm curious. I'm sure there are many people listening who are in leadership roles, but there are probably also just as many listening who maybe feel like they aren't in a role where they have the ability to lead. And I'm just curious for someone who, say, is maybe working under an ineffective leader, one of the challenges I find, my leadership skills there's always room for improvement, but I often find that I'll be supervised by someone who's less experienced in leadership. And so nothing gets done. And then I feel like I'm stuck between following and just watching this mess or stepping up and leading the group in what needs to be done. But then that would require stepping on the leader's toes, which I would not want to do because that's a way to create an enemy or get fired. So it's tough to be in this limbo to see like, oh, if only this could happen. I'm wondering if there's a way to help empower our leaders who don't have this experience.
This is a primary question that I address in all of the workshops and lectures and my most recent books is the dilemma of having all of these people, you know, who may be good at a technical aspect of their field and then they get promoted to a leadership position, but they have no leadership skills. No one's taught them how to be an effective leader. And this is very frustrating for the people underneath. And so one of the phenomena that we often see is a person who's more experienced who didn't get promoted will often, you know, take over certain aspects of leadership by default because the leader is ineffective. And the leader, him or herself, needs more leadership skills. And the people underneath need some social intelligence skills for how to function in situations where the leadership is off in some way. And how can you bring this to the organization's attention in a way that's not initially undermining the leader who may simply need more experience or training?
Yes.
Because a lot of times people just get frustrated with the leader who needs more training or experience, and then they start to undermine the leader just because they've had it. And they really don't care at that point whether they're fired or not, you know?
Yep.
They might even quit. But there are ways to bring the attention to the person who's leading, and perhaps, you know, as a way of moving forward, if you don't get any response, going above their head, but not to undermine the leader, but to engage the idea that the leader needs some training and support. We want to support this person to become the best that they can be. And right now, yeah, they were promoted because, you know, they were, let's say, a phenomenal counselor in a social service organization, and then they get promoted. You're going to need some skills that are different than when you're counseling somebody. You know, I work a lot with people who are in who are rocket scientists, let's say, do some workshops for Raytheon missile systems when they promote their engineers to leadership positions. They really know and understand this, and they've been getting these people some good training, because just because you can build a rocket and write some emails and design something in, you know, in an engineering context, doesn't you know how to work with people, how to communicate with people, how to motivate people. And they really understand that those skills are needed, not just technical expertise.
Thanks, Linda. And I also notice, like you said, people who are great at their job get promoted, but then they end up not doing the thing that they loved and were so great at. So it can actually burn out the people who get promoted as well, especially if they're not empowered with the skills that they need to do a fantastic job.
And I think that a lot of times people aren't prepared to understand what's going to be different about their job when they're promoted as a leader versus their job when we're engaged in their, just completely immersed in their area of technical expertise. So I think that a part of leadership training in an organization also needs to let people know what is the difference between being a manager of an engineering department and being an engineer in that department, or the difference between being a teacher and then being a vice principal or a principal. There's, you know, you have to recognize that you need some additional skills. You can't just keep doing the same thing you were doing in your old job.
I'm going away. Look into my eyes. The last Sunday of every month from 11 to 5. I want you here with me.
If you're one of the millions of Canadians who experience depression, anxiety, or some other form of mental illness, there's a free course that can help. The Wellness Recovery Action Plan is an evidence-based program that works. It's developed and facilitated by peers who have experienced their own mental health challenges and have used RAP to recover and maintain long-term stability. It's based on the key concepts of hope, personal responsibility, education, self-advocacy, and support. For more information about the free RAP groups hosted by Vancouver Coastal Health, visit their peer-led website, spotlightonmentalhealth.com.
The year is 2124. Civilization as you know it is gone. The last remaining archive of Vancouver's music, art, and underrepresented issues is the September 2018 issue of a magazine called Discorder. 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 The September issue of Discorder is out now. This month, there are pieces on Andrea Warner, the author of Buffy St. Marie's authorized biography, Commercial Drag, a weekly drag show for anyone and everyone, music features with local bands Landline and Board Decor, an art feature by Nada Hayek, live reviews of Ponderosa Festival, and Poetry is Bad for You, and of course, reviews of new albums, podcasts, and books. Thank you to our advertisers, The Rio, Blueprint, The Cinematheque, The Rickshaw Theatre, East Van Graphics, SFU, Timber Concerts, the Vancouver International Film Festival, the Vancouver Art Book Fair, and the AMS.
We are speaking with Linda Kohanov. She is the author of The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a revolutionary model for socially intelligent leadership. Her website is masterherder.com. And so maybe we can talk a little bit about the five roles.
Absolutely. When I was studying leadership, and like I said, I came across cultures that we call nomadic pastoral cultures, which means they migrate with large herbivores like horses and cattle, camels, goats, sheep. And they work with the animals. They have to build trust. You don't have them in fences. And they actually move large animals that are loose and keep them together, and they protect them, but they also nurture the group. And as I was studying these cultures, I could see that the parallels between working with free, empowered people now, because all the old fences have fallen down and people are much more free. And you can't have them just running across the landscape amok, you know. So what do these master herders do to keep these animals together? And I, as I was analyzing these different kinds of groups, the phenomenon of what I began to call the master herder emerged. And I use this term not in terms of master slave, but master herder in terms of someone who has self-mastery and mastery of five rules of power and social influence that they need to manage large groups of free, empowered animals. And so this master herder is a strong, compassionate, well-balanced leader who also acts as a caretaker and a guardian. So this person has to, as I mentioned, master five roles and use fluidly as needed. The roles are the leader, the dominant, the nurturer companion, the sentinel, and the predator. And in order to keep these large groups of herbivores together, they have to be able to use the leader and the dominant, the nurturer companion, and sentinel as non-predatory forms of power. And they have to separate the power of influencing the group from any form of power that's predatory. And a lot of people don't understand how to use power in non-predatory ways. And yet, you know, if you engage predatory power with free animals, what do you think they do?
Run away.
Run away, yes. So you have to be powerful and protective and build trust. You have to do so in such a way that you only reserve the power of the predator to keep life in balance with available resources, just as in nature. So human beings are omnivores. We have characteristics. We have the teeth more of a vegetarian, and we have our eyes forward more like a predator. So we all have these Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde moments where we're gentle and less predatory, and then other times where we've taught to use power in a predatory way. And as I came to study the difference between predatory and non-predatory power, I began to see our potential for nurturing each other and yet being assertive and empowered. That is entirely possible when you learn how to use all five of these roles.
Thank you. Yeah, there's a test to figure out what your dominant roles are. Assessment.
Yes, there's an assessment at the end of the book, The Five Roles of a Master Herder. And there's also an assessment that you can take online at the masterherder.com website. And so, you know, it may take a little, you have to understand the roles a bit in order to really interpret the results. And this particular assessment is designed for you to take with a particular professional situation in mind. So if you have multiple professional situations, you want to take the assessment for each situation. A bank president will take the assessment for his role as a bank president. And if he's head of a nonprofit or on the board of a nonprofit, he needs to take it for that organization separately, because the organization and your job description will cause you sometimes to overemphasize certain roles and possibly abdicate other roles. The idea with the master herder model is, no matter what your job description is, if you're going to really function at a high level and deal with the challenges of colleagues who are also empowered and may have different opinions than you do, or leading up with a leader who needs your help in order to lead a certain part of the project that he may not be familiar with, you really need to have access to all five roles and know when and how to use them. It's a new idea, because in our culture, we're taught to over-specialize. And that works well in technical fields. Like, so if you're going to become, you know, a pediatrician, you really need to specialize in medicine and medicine for children, you know. But in terms of leadership and social intelligence skills, it's more like reading, writing, driving a car, working a computer, and balancing your checkbook. To function in our culture, you need to have some reasonable facility of all five. So, you know, someone may be an amazing race car driver, you know, but the average person needs to be able to drive themselves safely back and forth to work. And some people may be phenomenal writers, but the average person needs to know how to write a good business letter of some kind. And, you know, there are definitely computer programming geniuses, but, you know, you and I know how to run a computer just to sit here and talk on Skype. So, you know, a lot of people try to over-specialize in these roles of leader, dominant, nurturer, companion, sentinel, and predator, but that's not what you need to do. You need to have facility in all five, and then realize which people in your family or on your team have the best functionality in a certain role. You might want to learn more about that role from that person by shadowing them. But also, if in a real tense situation, you want to send your best person in that role, but you don't want that person to always have to use that role because they need to learn how to use the other roles too.
There's so many directions we could take this conversation, but one thing I noticed that was interesting doing the assessment is how you mention in at the end of the book that people, and I imagine there are a lot of people listening to this show right now who would be high in the nurturer companion role just naturally, so we do tend to care about people, but because of that, people who are strong in that area can also end up as a last resort being high in the predator area. Why is that?
Well, this is a common thing with people who overemphasize the nurturer companion role, is that they don't know how to use the inspirational drawing visionary power of the leader. And they don't know how to use the power, the appropriate power of the mature use of the dominant role. The dominant role is the part of you that can break up fights between people. It's the part of you that can be directive, and it's the part of you that can handle conflict effectively. It's also the part of you that can push somebody out of their comfort zone when they're resistant. You know, so if you need to get your child up off the couch to go clean his room and you're only being sweet and nurturing, I can tell you that with most children, that's not going to be enough, right? So everybody needs to know how to use these different roles. The problem with somebody who overemphasizes the nurturer companion role is that their prime directive is to help everybody feel comfortable and valued and supported. And when you go to use the dominant or leader role, you actually have to either draw, inspire, and lead people out of their comfort zone. And with the really resistant ones, you're going to have to up the ante and push them out of their comfort zone. So if you are a nurturer companion and you're in a social service agency, let's say, and you're promoted, if you don't know how to use the leader and the dominant roles, you're actually not going to be very effective as a manager because you can't be supportive with some people when they are in conflict with each other or you, and you can't. So the refusal to use the leader and dominant roles is it's classic with nurture companions because you have to get comfortable with making others uncomfortable, which is in some sense against your prime directive. So some of the training we give to people who have a high nurture companion score when they get promoted or when they become parents, because parenting is a leadership role, is to help them work with horses to learn how to use assertiveness in such a way that you're not aggressive, but you can become increasingly assertive according to the situation. And that means increasing your tolerance for feeling uncomfortable, because it's going to be uncomfortable at first to push people out of their comfort zone or draw them toward a vision that they're not comfortable with. The problem with most nurturer companions is because they're conflict averse, is that rather than use the leader and the dominant roles, they'll opt to be supportive and kind and understanding and talking, and then just getting it. And because they won't use the other roles, then they go to the predator role, which means they're going to fire that person or they might fire themselves from an organization. So a nurturer companion who won't use, let's say, the leader and dominant roles will opt to go finally to the predator role when they've absolutely had it. And I had that inclination because I didn't like the dominant role. I've seen a lot of what we call immature dominance. And these are people who are naturally oriented to the dominant role. And when they're using this role in its immature form, it can be very intimidating and even abusive. And so that's the only model I ever had. of using a dominant role. And so I would do that. I would nurture and nurture, and then I would try. I'm pretty good with the leader. I would inspire. But some people just needed finally to be told that I need you to get on track here, and there are consequences if you don't. And I needed to be more directive. And so I tell people now, if I go to the dominant role with you, it's because I care about you and I want you to stay in the organization. And I'm willing to go into this place of discomfort with you and really lay it on the line and let you know how your behavior is affecting the organization and the behavior change we need to see. And I will, you know, insist. Because if I didn't care about you being a part of this organization, I'd just go straight to the predator role. I'd just ask you to leave, because that's easier sometimes to just finally get disgusted and ask somebody to leave, or to cull a relationship, to say, I just can't take this relationship anymore and leave, you know, rather than go to the dominant role first. But it is, if it's done well, it is the caring thing to do, to include people who aren't getting on track or maybe disrupting others or engaged in power plays with others that are unproductive.
Thanks, Linda. Now, you mentioned culling relationships from the predator mode. And I'm curious, you mentioned also that there is another assessment at masterherder.com, I believe, that is for interpersonal, like, relationship leadership, right?
Well, actually, I haven't finished that one yet.
Oh, okay.
Mostly because I've been doing a lot of touring for this book and didn't quite get to that one. So right now on the Master Herder website, you can take the professional assessment, and the benefit of doing it on the Master Herder website is that the results are calculated for you.
Oh, that's
you
nice.
Can take it at the back of the book, and there's a key for how you calculate the results, but that you really have to sit down and do some math with that. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, this gives you an idea of what roles you tend to be really good at, or sometimes we can even be addicted to certain roles. And then what role might you be abdicating or refusing to use? Because a lot of times if you abdicate a role and force others to step into that void, you're actually doing them a disservice. A classic example is, you know, let's say a nonprofit that wants to feed homeless in Vancouver. Somebody who is a visionary, a really caring visionary, creates a nonprofit for that purpose. And they have a vision, and they're out communicating to the community and investors and people they can raise money from. And then you have you need some social workers and counselors and volunteers who really care about the homeless. They all come in on board. And so in this situation, it can be really out of balance for a while, because you have a whole bunch of nurturer companions, and nurturer companions will also engage in passive aggressive power plays where everything goes underground. Mm-hmm. And they will often say that they're not even interested in power, but you can see that they are, because they'll engage in power plays, you know, and they often end up being giving somebody the silent treatment, let's say, or, you know, being offended with something somebody said, but not communicating how you want to be dealt with in the future. And so somebody doesn't even know they've offended you. And, you know, these crazy things start going on where factions are created, and there's all this gossip behind the scenes, but nobody's really dealing with conflict because everyone's conflict averse. And the leader's off, you know, focusing on the vision. One of the characteristics of somebody who overemphasizes the leader role is that they're constantly looking at the mission and the vision, and they can have very little tolerance for people's interpersonal issues or what somebody needs to actually fulfill the goal that the leader is bringing forth. A lot of times a leader wants to have a vision and have everybody else come along and fill in all the nitty-gritty boring details behind them, you know? And so the leader can appear to everyone else on the team to be very aloof and self-absorbed. But the leader's thinking, hey, I'm not aloof. I'm about feeding all the homeless here. I care. But, you know, they're not really caring about the dilemma that their staff is in trying to fulfill this vision. Mm. And if a leader doesn't have use of the dominant role, a lot of times the leader will become a workaholic, because Dominant role is the part of you that can be directive and can delegate and can make sure people get on track. And so a leader who lacks the dominant role will often get to a certain point and just say, you know what, it's just easier to do it myself. And that only takes organization so far, because if you have an ambitious goal, you can't do everything yourself. So you see a lot of ambitious organizations that are socially oriented that kind of fail or just stay in a kind of limbo because the leader can't get it together enough to let other people do the job and help get them the support they need to do the other jobs that need to be done. So often what happens in an organization like this is that sooner or later, they say, "We need here? We need a good middle manager here." And they're going to bring in somebody who they're asking really to play the dominant role, the one who's going to be directive, who's going to break up fights, who's going to tell people that these power plays are not going to happen anymore, who's going to, you know, everybody has a part of their job that's boring or tedious, right? And so a lot of times the dominant role has to step in when somebody is not functioning in the part of their job they just don't like. And what do you think happens to an organization if they don't have a leader that can actually say, hey, you need to get on track and you need to do this boring part of your job? What do you think happens?
Well, I've been in organizations like that and it falls apart. And the good people start to leave or they conform to the culture. And then it just creates, nothing really gets done and people end up working harder and harder and harder, spinning their wheels and getting less and less accomplished.
Exactly. And I've often seen too where, you know, so I need you to do a certain part of your job that's boring, or maybe you even need more training, but you just haven't stepped up to, you know, ask for some additional training. And if you're not doing that part of your job, then it's hard for me to do my job, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm more experienced in that area. So I might a couple of times take over that part for you. But now I'm starting to fall behind my job. And I'm getting resentful because I'm doing your job. And the visionary's off, you know, inspiring everybody and not coming back around saying, hey, you know, Marie, you need to get on it and do this part of your job. Because Linda is like not able to do hers. So, you know, the dominant is the one that steps in and says those things and then it puts a bit of pressure to, and it even has consequences for if you don't start doing that part of your job, Marie, then maybe you're not the right person for this job. You know, the dominant doesn't necessarily have to be mean or nasty or overly stern. It really is a matter of saying, hey, Marie, this is a part of your job description. You need to do this. I need to find out why you're not doing this, because if it's just because it's boring, that's one thing. We all have boring parts of our job. So I need you to get on it. But if you need more training, let's get you some more training. So a dominant can have a quality of the nurturer companion that's coming in and saying, what do you need to do this? But in organizations where the leader's off inspiring people and the nurturer companions are all trying to keep up and they bring in a dominant middle manager, what they do by abdicating the dominant role, all of them, is put the person in a terrible position of being the only one who will be the company disciplinarian. And by abdicating the dominant role, everyone else puts it all on this one person who then becomes the company bad guy. And by putting this person in the role of being exclusively the dominant, that person will overemphasize the dominant role, and then the dysfunction of the dominant role will start to show up, and everybody else will call this person abusive and intimidating. And so I often say that, you know, people who overemphasize the leader and the nurturer companion and sentinel roles actually engage in an unholy alliance with the dominant monster that they create. So they bring in somebody to do the dominant role, and while they need the service this person performs, they also love to hate him. It's a terrible position to put somebody in.
Yeah, there's, it's just, it's interesting how humans behave sometimes, because I've seen so many times where there'll be a manager who is, yeah, very dominant and even abusive, and the people who have options because they're great at their job, they leave, And then you're left with the people who are either less competent or just less confident. And then they end up feeling bad, and then their performance goes down, even if they might have been good under better leadership. But then the head person who's running the company or in charge of this manager doesn't do anything to, like, they might talk to the manager, but maybe they're a nurturer companion. So they just keep talking, oh, you know, you have to be nicer to people because they keep quitting. And after 10 conversations, nothing has changed, yet they're not letting the manager go, or nothing, the urgency of the situation isn't being escalated. And it just continues until the company literally falls apart.
Yeah, literally falls apart. And, you know, there's another weird thing that happens, especially in social service agencies and nonprofits, where you have a lot of really probably well-trained and confident people who have been taught to overemphasize the nurturer role because it's social service oriented. That often attracts a lot of people who tend to love that role. In that situation, you can have a nurturer companion power coup, I call it, and it can be very destructive. And I've seen it a number of times. It's where you have this visionary leader who's got this vision for feeding all the homeless, and he's being aloof and not delegating, and, you know, just letting everybody behind him, you know, pick up all the slack and figure out their own interpersonal dilemmas. And then you have all the nurturers who are playing these passive aggressive power games and giving each other the silent treatment and gossiping about each other behind their backs and creating factions. And then they bring in the dominant middle manager who becomes a bit of a monster, like you just described, because he's caused to overemphasize the role. And in that situation, I've seen several times an ambitious person who's overemphasized the nurturer companion role come in and do something that's quite a pattern. The nurturer says about the dominant, he's abusive. And the nurturer says about the leader, you know, he doesn't care about you guys. He's just focused on the mission. But I care. Come with me. And this person will become the informal leader by offering nurturing behavior that's free of goals and consequences. It's very seductive to everyone else to follow this person. But the entire organization just simply falls apart because you can't have that kind of imbalance going on and actually move forward and be effective.
Hmm. Thanks, Linda. Again, we are speaking with Linda Kohanov. She is the author of The 5 Roles of a Master Herder, a revolutionary model for socially intelligent leadership. The website is masterherder.com. Now, you are doing some classes. You're going to be traveling a little bit, running some workshops.
Yes, my primary job is to do trainings, sometimes in the form of workshops that anybody can sign up for and attend. So you'll see that list of workshops on both of my websites. And a lot of times I also travel and do lectures and workshops. And this year I'm going to France in June and ending up in Holland. And so I'll be doing some lectures in the Master Herder model so that people can just show up and get a feeling for it. And then I'll be doing some day-long workshops where I'm offering actual tools that you can take back to the workplace. And then I'm also doing some equine facilitated workshops where people can actually practice learning these skills through working with horses that are trained to help people learn how to be assertive without being aggressive, learning how to set boundaries without being cruel, and helping to learn how to set boundaries in such a way that connection is increased rather than using the boundary as a wall. And then also how to gain trust and how to be a trustworthy leader through working with horses. It's really quite an efficient way to learn these skills. And it's also very fun. And people who've never worked with horses before are just delighted. So rather than doing like role plays to learn these things, you're actually interacting with a horse who is not going to come with you unless you get all the pieces in place, you know. And a lot of these pieces are nonverbal. So if a horse is kind of trying to push you around, and you're setting a boundary with the horse by collapsing and yielding and backing up, Even if you're saying back off in a stern tone of voice, your body language of collapsing and yielding and backing off is what the horse is listening to. So a person learns that what they say has to be backed up by the body language and the energy and the presence to fulfill what it is that their intention is. And we also learn how to be assertive in such a way that it actually enhances the relationship with the horse. So people who are more nurturing and less assertive learn that actually my relationship with this horse improved when I got the right balance of assertiveness and also listening to the horse and being adaptable to the horse's needs. So I do equine facilitated workshops. I ran in outside of Tucson. And then I also travel around the U.S. and I'm going to Australia to do the same thing in late August, early September. So if you live in these other countries and you'd like to get a taste of this work and check out either one of my websites, I will be listing my international tours soon. But if you live in the U.S. or Canada or you're willing to travel to Arizona, you can come to Arizona in any number of usually most of my workshops are 3 to 4 days long, because when people are traveling to come here, they really want to travel and stay and learn rather than just do something that it's a half a day long. Mm-hmm.
That sounds amazing. Because, I mean, role plays are helpful because it's better to get some practice. But to be able to really practice those roles, oh, that sounds so exciting.
It really is. I work with, engineers who are building rockets. They come out here and a lot of times they say, why are we going out here with these horses? And then they come out and they realize that the horses are showing them sometimes unexpected talents that they have that they weren't conscious of. And the horses are showing areas of imbalance and ways in which they are not communicating effectively. Because a lot of people think, if I'm promoted to a leadership position and I send an email to somebody about something that they need to do in their job, they don't understand why half the time the person won't automatically do it. You actually have to have a real leadership presence and sometimes some follow-up and sometimes increasing follow-up for those who are more resistant. But in such a way that you build relationship and trust and respect long-term. And the horses really teach you how to do that in a matter of days.
Mm, beautiful. I just have so many questions. Yeah, because we have to learn how to effectively deal with so many different personality types, because with one person, the nurturer companion role might be 90% of the time the only role you really need to use. Whereas with someone else or under a different circumstance, you might need to be more insistent and to be more dominant.
And we actually learn an assertiveness formula, which is commitment plus crescendo plus immediate positive feedback equals assertiveness that's not aggressive or abusive. And what that means is you first have to be committed, not wishy-washy about the goal that you're asking someone to fulfill. So if I'm asking somebody to do the most boring, tedious part of their job, I actually have to be committed that that's their part of their job description and that it is vitally important that they do that part of their job. Because if I'm kind of like, well, I don't know, maybe you do or maybe you don't, I can tell you right now, most people are just simply not going to. Crescendo is a musical term that means that you start softly and you gradually increase the volume without dropping the volume. In terms of power, it's like if you have a power dial in your solar plexus, you're going to start at a 1, then you're going to move progressively from a 2 to a 3 to a 4 to a 5, all the way up to 10 if necessary, but you're going to do it progressively. And that immediate positive feedback means no matter how much power you had to engage, when the person starts to do what you ask, you need to say, all right, we're back on track here. Give them some positive feedback. A lot of time, by the time a person crescendos up to, let's say, a 5 on the power dial, the person starts to do what they ask, and the person just gives them the silent treatment or is resentful and says, yeah, it's about time you start doing this, rather than, okay, you're doing it, good, let's move forward. And so we often leave out the immediate positive feedback part. And with a lot of people, they engage what I call the 2-2-2-2-10 phenomenon, where they stay at a low level of power and influence. And they just stay at that level. And they send people a text, and then they send them another text. And then they have a little sweet, gentle conversation, and nothing's happening, and nothing's happening. And then finally, they just had it, and they fire the person, or they start screaming at the person. That's a 2-2-2-2-10 phenomenon. And that's the way most people use power when they come here, I'll tell you that much. And they learn then how to work the middle part of their dial and then give people immediate positive feedback.
That would be not just in business and work, but in what we already mentioned, parenting, but in dating too. Right?
It's a very useful tool in dating.
Yeah.
Yes. And you know, we have some horses here. At my place, I actually have a herd of horses that I've selected and trained and in some cases raised, who have different ways of interacting that are similar to different types of human personalities you'll encounter. So we have some horses that are really warm and generous and welcoming, and you ask them to do something and they're pleased to do it. That feels great. And then you might have another horse that is quite a bit more dominant. And one of the things a dominant horse will, when you ask them to do something, is they will refuse to do it. Dominant animals refuse to move. They move everybody else around all day, but nobody moves the dominant horse. So they might actually overemphasize the refusal to do something simply as a power play. And if you can break through that with them and give them immediate positive feedback, they're likely to be more and more accommodating over time, similar to dominant people. But I also have a horse, his name is Orion, and he's what I call a polite dominant. And he's actually very seductive. So a lot of people's romantic dilemmas come up when they work with him, because he's really sweet. He's incredibly handsome. He's a black, tall, Arabian mix. And he comes up to people, and he's got the big wide eyes, and he'll follow them around. But as he's following you around, he's starting to control your movement, and you can't really quite tell when it happens, because you're so happy to be engaged with this handsome, charismatic guy. And then all of a sudden, the next thing you know, he's pushed you right into the fence and you didn't even know when it happened. And so people are like, that happens in all of my relationships. I meet someone charismatic that I'm attracted to because they're powerful and they're very sweet. But then the next thing I know, they're ruling my life. How did that happen? And so we actually teach people to sense the moment when it's starting to happen and how to regain your own space and authority in the relationship.
Wow. Oh my gosh. That's so exciting. I have to know more. Okay. So you can go to masterherder.com. We've been speaking with Linda Kohanov. She is the author of The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a revolutionary model for socially intelligent leadership. Again, that website is masterherder.com. So we just have a couple minutes left in the show, Linda, and I'm wondering what you feel is either hasn't been mentioned or that you'd really like to focus on for the last few minutes.
Well, I think one of the ways to look at this constructively is to see the use of the roles themselves as a crescendo, so that if I have a resistant employee who may be causing trouble in some way or another, I'm going to sit down with them and I'm going to have a nurture companion conversation with them. I'm going to find out, you know, are they resistant because they need additional training? Or is there conflict among team members that's causing them to have a block? Is there something going on in their life personally that is causing them to be a little more negligent than usual? And, you know, if we move forward and the person still isn't shifting, then I'm going to have a sentinel conversation with them. And the sentinel is the part of you that steps back and watches group dynamics in relation to threats and opportunities in the environment. And so when we see a shepherd guarding his flock, the shepherd's engaged in the sentinel role. But when you have a sentinel conversation with a person, you're going to talk to them about how their behavior is affecting their team and the team's effectiveness, and how that's affecting the mission, you know, the company goals, and how that affects the company's ability to serve the customer. You can just have a really straightforward conversation about that. And if that's not working, I crescendo up to the leader role. I have a conversation about, you know, what is really the mission and vision of this company? And how does their role work, or how does their job fit into the mission and vision? And why is that important? And then also, what are opportunities for promotion in the future if this person can move through this initial difficulty? If the leader isn't working, then I go to the dominant. And the dominant gets more directive and says, okay, you've had this many opportunities to shift. Clearly, I have to push you out of your comfort zone here. So if I don't see this report by this date, this will be the consequence. And then you crescendo up through the dominant role by giving the consequence. And I usually give them one more consequence that's more intense. And then the last thing the dominant does is let them know the predator's coming in next. And so if the person has gone through all these steps and they are not changing their behavior, then they come into my office and I say, you know why you're here, don't you? It's time for you to leave. You're obviously not a good match for this company. And I already told you this was going to happen. So I don't have to raise my voice. I don't have to shame the person. I don't have to feel guilty or conflicted about it. It's just clear this was about to happen. And there were many chances before for this person to get on track.
Wow. That is powerful and really, really helpful. Thank you so much, Linda. I wish we had more time. Everyone can go to your website, though, masterherder.com. The name of the book is The 5 Roles of a Master Herder, a revolutionary model for socially intelligent leadership, which is what we need. We need more social intelligence in this time, in this world right now. Linda Kohanov, thank you so much for being with us today, Linda.
Thank you, Marie. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you. Well, it's time to go now. So I really thank Linda for spending time with us. And thank you for being with us this hour. I hope this has served you well. Be well. Namaste. Up next is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Arific on CITR.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is Monday.
From 1 to 3 p.m.
Who is this guy? Does he have a name? Let me know where he's from. From Parts Unknown.
My name's Chris Arific.
You always wanted his character to be bigger than life.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is without question the greatest sports and entertainment event of all time. Be a part of it Monday.
From 1 to 3 p.m.
The Parts Unknown Show on 101.9 CITR. Sometimes cosmoses collide.
Break your fingers.
Tune in every Tuesday afternoon from 1 to 2 p.m. for the Community Living Show. Join host Michael, Kelly, and friends on CITR 101.9 FM and also online at www.citr.ca for the Community Living Show, right after the morning after show.
Are you starting fresh this year and looking for new, exciting activities to do with friends on campus? Did you watch theater in high school and now miss it? Feeling overwhelmed and need a break? Come and escape to another world through thrilling live performance right on campus. Celebrate with us the 60th anniversary of UBC Theater and Film's 2018-19 season. Still need more convincing? It's only $11.50 for UBC students with your card. And bring your ticket into Kerner's after the show to get 10% off your food. Check out theaterfilm.ubc.ca today.
Timber Concerts and CITR presents Shannon and the Clams with guests Sevilla, Thursday, October 4th at the Wise Hall. Advanced tickets are available online at ticketweb.ca and are also available at Red Cat Main Street, Red Cat Hastings Street, and Zulu. Timber Concerts and CITR present Idols with guests Bambara, Thursday, October 4th at the Rickshaw Theater. Tickets are available online and at Red Cat Main Street, Red Cat Hastings Street, and Zulu. Australia and Canada both have wide open spaces and wild sounds that fill them. Join your host, Matt, as he shares brand new tunes and archived classics from the independent music worlds of Australia and Canada on Stranded, the Australian-Canadian music show. Listen Tuesdays from 11 p.m. to midnight.